good morning. How are you this morning? I hope you're having a good day. It's gotten a little colder outside. I stepped out with a very light jacket on and said, whoa, wait a minute, I've got to go back in and get my leather jacket. It's a little bit colder today, but you know that usually we have my guest on the last Thursday of the month, but we're doing it the fourth Thursday of the month because I am heading towards warm California, and so I've asked James Anderson, the Marion County, and I'm hitting the wrong buttons here, the Marion County naturalist to come in today. How you doing, James?
I'm wonderful.
Oh, I got to find the right one here. Are you still on?
Hello.
Oh, yes.
Good morning.
Yeah, because you're sitting in a different place. Okay, I got you. Understood that the weather wasn't going to be perfect for the rest of March and April, all right? This is the time of the year that we all have to wear jackets.
Yeah.
Or at least carry one.
Well, it was funny. Those, you know, last few days, you know, it was in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. So a lot of business out at the Tallgrass Trail.
Oh, my goodness. You probably, if you follow our social media,
yes,
Tallgrass Trail or the Instagram account, yes, a lot of things are happening right now. Especially with a lot of our slimy and slithery friends.
Yes, I have a complaint. I don't want to see garter snakes.
Oh, yes. So, yes, this is the time that they are coming out of hibernation. And if you just saw yesterday, I posted a video that someone found at the Tallgrass Trail. And I'm not sure what part of the trail. But they were in a big mating ball or mating frenzy.
Saw that.
And, you know, they're just there just doing their thing. They're not there to hurt you or harm you. You know, once they do their business, they're all going to separate and they're just all going to live their little lives. And
now, so they were having fun yesterday, but today their blood has gotten really thick and they're probably slowed down.
Yes.
Is that what happens? Does their blood get thick?
No, it doesn't get thick. Okay. They just really slow down.
Yeah.
So they really need to be above 50 degrees, but they really prefer anything above 60. And then if they get about 80 degrees, then they can actually get too hot, and then they want to cool down. Because you got to remember, being reptiles, being cold-blooded, they can't sweat or shiver like you and I can.
Right.
You know, when we sweat to cool off and shiver to warm our bodies, well, reptiles, amphibians, fish, and insects don't have that ability.
Now, I was quite interested in that mating ball. How many critters get into that?
So it depends. Around here, I mean, it could range from 20, 30 sometimes.
Goodness,
but there is some place in Canada, and I can't remember where, but it's almost by the thousands.
Oh, my
goodness.
And
there's just, they're covered everywhere.
That's the biggest nightmare of my life.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that. I got that a lot on the that post yesterday.
Yeah, I bet you did.
And something else I learned, well, I remembered it, but then I kind of forgot it, but something else that the males would do, a lot of people don't realize, the females are larger, the males are smaller.
Oh, okay.
And he's basically have to pin her down.
Okay.
And that shows physical fitness, and that will show that, you know, if he's able to pin her down, then he's going to produce better young.
Basically caveman sex.
Yeah, I guess you can put it that way, yeah. But what he'll do is call an anoxious kiss. And what they do is basically, remember, you know, how in life you breathe in and then you breathe out?
Yeah.
Okay, when you exhale, well, they're basically deoxygenating the area, and they're trying to put around her nostrils. Well, a bunch of males are doing that same time, and she's not getting fresh oxygen. She's going to slow down.
Uh-huh.
And actually, too much, it can kill her.
Oh, jeez.
So, snake love is very interesting.
Well, it's kind of snaky.
I see what you did there.
Now, how many females are in a ball? Is it just one?
It's usually ranges about, it can be about 4 to 5, sometimes a little bit more, but usually you're going to have more males than females.
Boy, I'm glad I'm not a female.
And so, yeah, if you see the mating ball and you see the big one, then you'll know, okay, that's the female.
I assume you should leave it alone.
Oh, yeah, leave them alone.
Yeah. They're not hurting anybody.
No, they're just doing their thing.
Yeah, they're probably in ecstasy.
Yes. You can put it that way, yes.
Well, we just had Miss Dr. Ruth on, so.
Oh, yes, that's right.
I'm sure she could have explained all that mating ball stuff.
Yes, she probably could.
All right. Well, I see you brought a bunch of interesting books in. Why don't we start talking about
them? I did. Actually, I brought in binoculars, books, and different things. So,
binoculars, too.
Yeah, so today's subject I want to talk about is Birding 101.
Good.
So hopefully after today's program, you'll get a little introduction into birding, especially if you're very new or maybe you haven't done it in a while. And I'm going to be talking about some of the different types of equipment you may need and how to use that equipment, and just some different spots around our area that you can go birding. So you don't have to travel far. We're very fortunate to have a lot of great diversity of birds.
Well, I've been, as I think I've talked to you about, sitting out in my backyard
and
watching the birds in my backyard, and I'm amazed. I have found a terrific website. Well, there are all sorts of terrific apps.
Yes, that a lot of apps and websites.
That are free. That you can, it'll...
Audubon, that's a great one.
Do they? Okay, I don't have that one. But they, you can get them that will mimic the birds. Well, you can hear the bird...
It's a recording.
Yeah, it's a recording of the bird's call, and ones that the one I'm using right now. It's you tell the app what size bird it is, and then it tells you in your area, because it knows where you are. In your area, these are the birds that fit into that size.
Yeah.
Then it narrows it down. Is it a colorful bird? Is it a not so colorful? Then it narrows it down even more to what the coat looks like. Is it a coat?
Plumage.
The plumage looks like, and then it will tell you what you're looking at. I love it.
Yeah, there's some special apps that do like a process of elimination.
Do you like doing it? I mean, you're a young man. There are a lot of people that think birding and gardening are only for old guys.
People. Yeah. That's kind of funny. Birding, I mean, for a long time, yes, it was kind of geared for the older generation, for the older folks, I guess you could say.
Not a lot of exercise involved in it.
You'd be surprised.
Well, if you have to go out.
Yeah, if you got to go out and you got to hike. I mean, I've been where I've hiked 5 or 6 miles just to look at a type of bird or a group of birds.
Yeah.
So if you know where the special spots are, I mean, you're going to do a little hiking.
Yeah, okay, cool. Well, let's get going.
Yeah, so, of course, the first type of equipment to be a successful birder is a pair of binoculars.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, you don't need them, absolutely, but 9 times out of 10, where do you see your birds? Are they up close or are they far away? They're typically far away.
You can't do it without having binoculars.
Yeah.
I even have binoculars in my backyard.
Oh, yeah.
Because... even when the birds get up in the top of my trees, that's 40 or 50 feet away from me.
Yeah, and there's
and you can't quite
so limit them. Of what our eyes can do. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So is there a
yes, there are sizes. And that's the thing. If you're very new to binoculars and you'll see all these weird numbers, there's two numbers. There's the first, and I'll kind of explain about the numbers. But like this pair is an 8x46. I brought in a smaller pair by 10x25. And they can go, again, all sorts of sizes. And I'll kind of explain about which size is great for what group of birds. So that first number, so we'll use the smaller pair here. So
is that a camera binocular as well?
No, this is just a small pair of binoculars.
Because it's kind of hefty looking.
Yeah, some of them can be a little bulky. Some of them can be a little bit more thin. You know, they come in all different designs. So that first number you'll see on the pair of binoculars, that will represent the magnification power.
Okay.
So in this case, it will tell me I will see that subject or bird 10 times closer than with my naked eye.
Because the number is 10.
Yeah, the number is 10.
Okay.
Now, like this pair, it's, let's see, what is it? I believe it, this is a 12 by 46. So all that means I'm going to see that image 12 times closer.
Okay.
Think of it like a microscope setting. Now, I know microscopes and binoculars have different reasons, but, you know, it's the same concept, you know, as the magnification for 100, 200, 1,000. You know, you're seeing that image a lot closer.
Now, I'm guessing if the bird is 50 feet away from you, 48 feet away from you, and it's a 12, then it's really looking like it's only 12 feet away from you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And that's what the binocular is for, to see these birds are far away, to make them look up very, very close. And that second number, so that is the objective lens diameter, and it will show the how far of the objective lens, or the part that we don't put our eyes on, how far it is in millimeters. Now, that's going to tell us a couple things. Obviously, the first thing it's going to tell us is about the size slash kind of weight of the binocular. So if that number is high, what do you think is going to happen to the size of the binoculars?
Well, they'd have to be longer.
Yeah, they're going to be longer. Yeah. They're going to increase. But if it's smaller, then obviously the binoculars are going to be smaller.
Okay.
So, and I'll kind of talk about here in a little bit, if you get a very big pair, you know, how to kind of counterfeit, because, you know, if you're out there in the wild, after a while, it hurts your neck, hurts your shoulders, so.
Well, I was given, when I was younger, probably in my early 60s, I was given a pair of binoculars that do have a camera on it. Yeah. Unfortunately, I've lost the little disc that you have to have so that I can plug it into my computer. But they work fine as a binocular. But they're pretty small. But they work great. They're Bushnell glasses, so I guess they're pretty good as far as the lenses go. But I would like to get a bigger pair.
Okay.
But wouldn't it be better if you have like not a tripod, but a monopod?
You can do a
monopod. For the big ones?
You can. Something that you can use to help prevent your neck and your shoulders from hurting. There's just a backpack or a chest harness.
Oh, chest harness.
Yep. It just basically goes the straps on the side, and so it prevents all that weight. Then if you really, really have neck, shoulder problems, there are like little, I guess, kind of little pods or kind of little poles that go off the side, and then they kind of tuck in your chest harness. But the problem about that is, people, we tend to move. Even if we try to sit still, we're always kind of moving in some way. So you need to stand next to a building, a tree, a friend, I guess.
Yeah.
So you need some type of structure to help you out, because if not, you're just going to be kind of moving, and then next thing you know,
and you're breathing, that's going to move.
You're going to be breathing, So something else that second number is also kind of give us an indication about how much light is going to penetrate through the binoculars. And with that larger number, that's going to tell us we're going to get a more crystal clear image.
But
if that number is smaller, I mean, yes, you'll get a decent image, but it's not going to be as nice if that second number is a lot higher.
I found that mine, I do have a bigger pair, a really old bigger pair, and I do get a little bit better view through those.
For the bigger,
but they're really heavy.
And then that's the kind of the disadvantage. So you know you got to take your pros and your cons. So when we were, remember we were talking about the magnification power. So I always tell people that if you're looking for different groups of birds, you may want different types of binoculars. So if the magnification or that first number is above a 12, that means again we're going to see that subject very, very close. It's really going to channel in to our subject. Now that's going to be good for like lake, wetland, pond birds, like ducks and waterfowl and geese and swans.
They all sit in one place?
Typically.
Yeah.
But the big thing is there's not a lot of vegetation. Because when that number is really big, the problem is if you're in a thick forest setting like Hocking Hills or what, you know, with all the leaves and the trees. I mean, don't get me wrong, I have used it, and I've had experienced birders use a magnification power that was really high, but you really, really have to train yourself. So if you're really new, I wouldn't recommend anything above a 12, or 12 or above. Go with anything 10 or under for forest birds. Also for open land, grassland setting species, I would recommend 12 or above in that magnification power.
Now, birds that are flying are hard to keep in track.
They are, and I even struggle with that, especially if it's smaller birds. Now, like we were talking before, like herons and cranes and swans, you know, they're a little bit easier to keep track, but your little, like, songbirds and all, it's a little challenging.
Yeah, and if they're a colorful bird, it's easier, too.
Yeah.
Like, I can find my cardinals, like, a snap of a finger when they're in the trees. But if I'm looking at a house sparrow, it's pretty hard to find
them. They're very cryptic. They do kind of, you know, stay really well camouflaged. Now, before I end about binoculars, just some little tips and tricks on how to utilize a pair of binoculars. Yeah. A lot of people just saying, oh, that's easy. I just bring it up and I look at my subject. Well, you can. But if you do that, what the problem is we'll say the bird is directly across you and me. Okay. Yeah. And then if I lift it clear up, what am I doing? I'm not looking directly at you. I'm above.
Yeah.
Right? So my ornithology instructor always told us that stare at the bird, if you can. This isn't always a scenario, but if you can, about at least 10 seconds or so. Once you have a good eye on your subject or your bird, then slowly lift up your binoculars. How my elbows are kind of bending?
Yeah. Right?
That will hold your binoculars in place.
But don't move your eyes or your head, though.
Yes, like, try
the binoculars to your eyes rather than
move your head. Now, I also tell people, too, if you're also very new to binoculars and, you know, when you're trying to find the perfect pair, I always tell people is once you find a pair, then what you do is start in your house slash property. Start with an object that's pretty big and use your binoculars, again, lifting up your arm slowly. Mm-hmm. Once you get comfortable with that, then find items that are smaller and smaller and smaller, because mm-hmm. most of our birds are only at least a couple inches.
Yeah.
So as long as you keep training yourself, you know, you'll be pretty successful. The only problem, you know, you may encounter if you do anything outside, especially if you live here in Marion, you know, you may look like the local creep. So just keep that in mind. You don't want the cops calling on
you. Don't look at your neighbor's back window.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So just keep that in mind.
My
I know, it makes you laugh. My
wife struggles to look through binoculars. She cannot find the critter that we're looking for.
Yeah.
I will tell her that, because I'm pretty sure she just
whips it up. Yeah.
And so we'll talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. Tell her again, at least 10 seconds or so.
Yeah.
And then
get steadied.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got you. I don't have any problem. Well, I have some problems, but most of the time I can find the bird, as long as he's not flying.
Yes.
If he's flying, that's a little different.
It is, yeah. And I even struggle with that. Like you said, the small little sparrows, you know, especially if they're in their vegetation, they're a little hard to find.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Okay, cool.
So some of the other equipment that I brought, again, it's not a total necessity, but it's definitely a good thing to have, is, of course, a field guide. Now, luckily, in today's time, there are a ton of different types of field guides, and I'll kind of explain about, you know, which one you should probably look at the most or what. But I always ask yourself, since there's such a diversity of field guides, do you like paintings or do you like drawings? Now, the ones that you were probably growing up with, Glenn, was probably Peterson's and Golden Guides. And probably the listeners that are out there, you may even have that field guide book on hand.
I don't.
but this one, what I have in my hand, this is Kaufman. It's set up like Peterson. And so it's got the birds, and it's got these little points about all the different identifying characteristics for each species of what you're looking at.
Yeah.
And again, that's how Peterson's set up, but what I don't like about Peterson's is their drawings. But I'm not saying Peterson's are bad, it's just my preference. I've had some people say they like the drawings more because it's more detailed, and I'm like, how can you get more detail than the real thing?
Yeah.
But I guess everybody is different. Now, some of these field guides are very easy to carry, like this Kaufman one. You can stuff it in your pocket, your backpack.
Kind of narrow, so it fits. Yeah.
Then, of course, you do have very thick ones.
Yeah.
Right?
You better have a backpack.
Or what I recommend, if you do have a really thick one, this one's Stokes. They cover all the birds of North America. Now, the other one did too, but what's nice about this one, they'll show a lot of the different color variation or genetic variations that birds can come in. I tell people that if you have this book and you don't want to carry it around, if you have a camera, take a picture, and then, you know, go home, you can go through your book and say, oh, okay, well, I think it was that bird. So that's where these thick books can kind of come in handy, and that's what I always recommend to people.
Now, I just looked up the one that I'm using. I am using the Audubon.
The Audubon, yep.
Identifying pages. It's very, very good.
It is. Yeah. It is. I do enjoy that program, too.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah.
So in today's times, there's ones that are specific to our state or our region.
That's what I have.
Yeah. In my hand, it's a Birds of Kentucky. I do have a Birds of Ohio, but I didn't grab it. It's in my car. So, and then there are even some field guide books that are only specific to even a specific region. A lot of national parks, state parks, some park districts will do that, or sometimes it's more in a brochure form. Because sometimes when you're looking at the birds of North America, you're like, oh my gosh, there's so many different birds.
Yeah.
But then when you're narrowed down to your specific state or specific region, all right, then it can be a little bit easier to find the bird that you're at your local park or your backyard. Now, do keep in mind when we're kind of talking about that, when you are picking out a field guide book, there are a lot of field guide books that are split off into different regions. And what I mean by that, Audubon does this, Sibley's does this, I think Golden Guides does this, but there's like Eastern Region and Western Region. Mm-hmm. So don't accidentally do what my one friend did in college. He accidentally picked up a book for Western birds, so everything west of the Mississippi. And as we were in class, we were going through all of our birds, and he's like, man, I can't find any of the birds we're looking at. And he said, what's wrong? I looked at his field guide, and I said, yeah, it is a little different. And I looked on site. It was very, very fine print. Mm-hmm. And it said, It said Audubon birds for western region. And I'm like, yeah, this book is not relevant for
and
you.
And that's west of the Mississippi.
Yeah, west of the Mississippi.
Okay. All right.
Now, don't get me wrong. There are some overlaps.
Yeah, I'm sure there
but
are.
But most of the birds that in that western book, no, you're not going to find in Ohio.
Robins are in California like they're in New York, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But you may not find something that's a western bird that only lives out in California.
Yeah, absolutely. And then if you're really into serious into birding, but you're having trouble with a particular group of birds. For me, it's a lot of gulls, terns, and warblers. If you're not familiar, warblers are a type of songbird, which are slowly coming back into Ohio. So that's what's nice about today's time. So instead of going through all the birds of North America, this only focuses just on warblers. So I can go through, and if I'm just looking at warbler species, I'm like, oh, okay, well, it's this warbler species. Mm-hmm. So that's what's really nice. And, of course, there are really more advanced books. These are kind of basic or kind of for intermediate birders, but more advanced, they really get into detail, especially for gulls and terns, because sometimes just the slightest little mark determines different species.
Well, I've noticed that. We have a lot of house wrens, or at least that's what I've identified them as, house wrens in our backyard. But
there's another wren that you'll visit your area.
They're all different, yeah.
There's house wren, there's Carolina wrens. There's probably, I think, up to 10 different species of wrens in Ohio.
So the only one that I found in my app that even was close was the house wren.
Now, summertime, you could have the Carolina wren. Okay. So they are slowly coming back into Ohio.
Okay.
So just keep that in mind. You know, a lot of birds are permanent residents, but we do have some that do migrate.
But all house wrens are not like twins. They aren't identical to each other.
No, they of course. There are some differences.
Some markings. So yeah. You can't count on the one that's in your book may not look exactly like the one you're looking through your binoculars.
Yes, and you know, it's actually funny that you said that. So, as we were talking earlier about the field guides, and I'm trying to find, but red-tailed hawks are a great example of
that.
We
have a lot of those in this area.
Yes. Right? Yeah. So, the thing about red-tailed hawks is you can find them throughout most of North America, but the problem is depending on certain ecosystems, they will look different. So, the ones that will look... Oh, there we go. There's birds of prey. So, the ones that will look different, like in a desert region, they're going to be a lot lighter. But the ones in very swampy environments, they're going to look a lot darker. So, same species, but again, different.
They've evolved
to their environment.
Yeah. I can understand.
Maybe I'll have to find off air. But yeah, okay. This book shows just a lot of the wide variety of what red-tailed hawks can come in. Now, here in Marion County, we actually do have a very rare case of a different red-tailed hawk that looks different. It's called leucistic. I know we might have mentioned it before. It's similar to albinism or albino animals, mm-hmm. but other than being white, what's the other characteristic that albino animals have?
Pink eyes?
Pink eyes, red eyes, yes. Well, leucistic animals do not have that red eye or pink eye. In this red-tailed hawk's case, yes, it's predominantly white. Now, some cases with leucistic wildlife, including birds, they may have mostly white, but they still may have some of their other dark pigments that their original look would look like.
Huh. Interesting.
So he hangs around the Marion-Carnington area.
Oh, so there's one currently here.
Yes, yeah, and he's been in alive, I think, for at least 8 years. One of our local photographers, Lola Pryor, she's got a lot of photography for him. So
I think I've seen her stuff on Facebook.
Yes. So if you're on Facebook, type in leucistic or leucistic red-tailed hawk, and you'll see all kinds of beautiful pictures.
Yeah. That's one of the things I've gotten to use. You know, a lot of people hate Facebook.
It's got its uses and, of course, its disadvantages.
But it's a great place to go to find out about critters in the area, I think.
Yeah,
because there are a lot of people that are taking... I take a lot of pictures of flowers and stuff like that, and I put them on there. I'm kind of proud of them, so I put them on there. And it's a good place to find lots of flowers, but also animals, especially unusual animals.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. So, one thing before I end about field guides, and I know it's the boring part, but read at least, you know, that beginning portion before it starts into the identifying part.
Why is that?
Well, because a lot of times your field guide books, what they'll do is they'll show you on how to use the guide, right? Like in this case, they'll show me about what all these colors represent. Because if you go into the book and you see all these colors, like, well, I don't know what that color represents on the map, but looking at the beginning, it will help you. Uh-huh. It'll give you tips and tricks, maybe how to become a successful birder, maybe parts or the
parts
anatomy.
To look at, yes.
Because a lot of the times your books are going to say, well, this bird has this color on its nap or its crown or its wing bar or its speculum. And you're like, what in the world does that mean? Well, again, reading those, it's usually about first 50 pages or so in most field guides.
Well, one of the things that really identifies certain birds from other birds is that little crown that they have, that little pointy thing like a cardinal has.
Yeah, it's called a crest.
Okay.
Now, yeah. Not all species have a crest.
Yeah, but, you know, that's an initial identifier.
Yes, you're absolutely right, yeah.
And if you look at, let's say, an oriole and you think, well, that's a blue jay because it's got blue on it,
yeah.
Well, you can tell that it's not because it doesn't have the head shape or something
yeah,
like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Sorry.
No, you're fine. So something else you may want to bring, and this is just optional, but I always tell people, bring you some type of field checklist, also call a life list for birders. And they're basically just little pamphlets, or if you don't want a pamphlet, you can go just write it down on a piece of paper. But basically it shows about when you saw the bird, a little check mark, and maybe a location. Now some field checklists are a little bit fancy. What they'll do is they will show you, hey, maybe you can find this bird year-round. Maybe you can find this bird in the summer or in the winter. Some of the field checklists are what they'll do. I have one that's from Kentucky, and there's a very long trail in Kentucky, and I forget what it's called. Oh, it's a James John Audubon Trail. Well, it's the same species of bird, but maybe you saw it on this portion of the trail or that portion on the trail. So they're all set up different, so definitely just kind of keep in mind if you want one. And most 9 times out of 10, field checklists are typically free. You can usually get them from Ohio Division of Wildlife. If you come out to any of our nature programs, we usually have a bunch of them we hand out.
Do you have out there in the little house?
Yeah,
you have
building.
A lot of brochures.
Yeah, yeah,
stuff?
We have a lot of identification pamphlets from ODNR.
Cool.
Not just birds. We got spiders and fish and all kinds of things.
Snakes.
Yep.
Of course,
snakes.
I'd want to have a snake.
Oh, yeah.
Identifier, so I can know where to run.
There you go. Well, snakes are everywhere.
Yeah, I know they are, and I don't really mind them as bad as I make it sound.
No, you're fine. You're fine.
I don't want to carry one, but. Yeah. Okay, so now if you, you got your binoculars, you got your identifying things, are there places that you can go on the online or something like that
yeah.
to identify locations where there are lots of that type of animal? I want to go see cardinals. Where do I go?
So, of course, like we mentioned about Facebook, there are a lot of Facebook groups out there, and, you know, there's ones that are specific to our region or Ohio or Central Ohio. There's ones that cover across just North America. So, of course, you can say, hey, I'm looking for this kind of bird. You know, where can I go? And some of those sites will be nice, and some of the people will like, hey, you can go here. But if it's a really rare bird, a lot of times people are going to be stingy and they'll say, well, I saw this, but I'm not going to tell you where I found it.
Oh, that seems so odd.
But there's some people that do it for the wrong reason than do that, and there's some people that do it for the right reason, because there's some people that try to protect the animal, and I kind of do that with, especially with birds of prey or owls
yeah.
especially, because unfortunately if I tell you, you tell your friend, they tell their friend, everybody's all flocking and could, you know.
Flocking, good term.
Yeah, okay. You know, could kind of stress the owl out,
and
unfortunately it could pass away or, you know, move on.
Now, do you find on the internet people are scamming other people about, you know, I saw a tiger out there on the north side of the tall grass trail.
Of course we do. We always get people that say they'll see all kinds of interesting things, and not just our parks, but I see it across all the social media.
So be careful.
Oh yeah.
As
yeah.
always.
Absolutely.
Yeah, people do lie.
Yes. But, of course, ODNR, with their free publications, I forgot to mention for the identification books, there are ones that are for free from ODNR, which we have and we give away. But what's nice is sometimes they will give you an ideal area, what part of Ohio. Maybe you can find the bird. Sometimes what time of year you can find that species of bird. So some of those field guides might do that, but some don't. Usually the ones that are very specific to your region, they usually help you out in that way.
Well, on the Tallgrass Trail alone, you can go one place and find things,
oh, yeah.
and you walk 2 miles down the trail
and see something completely different. Yes, yeah, you're absolutely right.
Because of the environment.
I think I've counted. There's at least 6-7 different types of habitats the whole Tallgrass Trail. From
that many,
from different types of forests to open lands to grasslands, our lake, our pond. Like you mentioned, different habitats are going to have different diversity of birds. So, yeah. Again, like you mentioned, I could travel a mile, the first mile, and see a great group of birds. I can travel 3 more miles and see another group of birds.
Now, do you find, because my favorite is one you introduced me to, basically, is the bald eagle. Yeah. Do you find that the bald eagle is more in the area at the beginning of the Tallgrass Trail where the lake is and stuff like that?
So that's where primarily, yes, you will see them. Now, I do tell people if you want to go to another location, if you park there at either the 203 Wildlife Area or at the Epsiefield Baptist Church, it's only a quarter mile to the trail, go by the Hickory Grove Campground. So if you're coming from 203, it's right before the campground.
Okay.
There's a little wetland area.
Okay.
There's some bald eagles that hang around. But if you're starting from the church I mentioned, you got to go past it.
Okay.
And it's usually it's right there on your left or your right.
Do they hang around there to get food, or are they nesting in that
area? I think they have some type of nest nearby, because usually I'll see at least 2 or 3. And, they're getting food a lot, but I think there must be a nest, because if they're going to hang around a spot for quite a period of time, I think that they've got some sort of nest structure.
Now, I know you can identify big birds' nests because they're big.
Yeah.
But can you, if you're going on, I have a new nest in my tree and I don't know what bird it is. Can you identify what type of bird it is by the way they built their nest?
Yes. So, most sparrows are usually going to build them the same. A lot of your groups are usually going to typically build the same, but there are some species that do make very specific nests, like Baltimore Orioles make a really interesting nest.
Hummingbirds, I assume, are very small.
Yes, yes. And there are actual field guide books that are designed just for nests. I think the best one is the Peterson one.
Okay.
So if you go on Google or what, type in Peterson nest, bird nest field guide, and you can get it that way.
Can you tell it from, with a pair of binoculars from...
Sometimes I can,
several feet away?
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay.
So, and other times, at least I say, okay, that's a sparrow nest. At least I knew what group it belongs to.
Yeah.
But the actual specific species sometimes is a little bit to determine or distinguish. But then once they lay their eggs, then I'm like, oh, okay. If I get a up-close opportunity, then I'm like, oh, you're a field sparrow, or oh, you're a song sparrow.
You can tell by the color of the
egg. Yeah, because the eggs are usually different sizes or sometimes different designs. So that's how you can really determine different species of the same group.
And I just started watching birds seriously. Yeah, I'm not terribly serious about it, but I just started probably 3 years ago. Yeah. And the first thing I learned is I had to quit beating myself up, because all I could do is identify it as a sparrow. I couldn't say that it was a house sparrow or any other type of... I got a sparrow. And... bird watchers will be people that are good at it will be able to tell you where their mother came from. But I'm just happy to know that I'm looking at a sparrow. So I think you've got to not beat yourself up because you aren't, the great identifier of birds.
No, and I, everybody starts somewhere. I didn't start this until college. Ornithology, if you're not familiar with ornithology, study of birds. When I had to take that course at Hocking College, that's where I kind of started my whole birding experience. So I've only been birding since 2010 when I took the course. So I haven't been birding for terribly long. Some people have been birding for 30, 50 years.
Yeah. I know some people like that. And be careful. If you're in a science like that, there are some people that will treat you poorly if you're not brilliant about it.
Yes. And I have met some people that way.
It's kind of a snooty thing.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Kind of going along with that, the ones you'll typically see there a lot are those kind of people. McGee Marsh. During the last week of April.
That's not a person's name.
No, no. Oh, okay. The McGee Marsh Wildlife Area up by Port Clinton, Lake Erie.
Oh, yeah.
So they have the biggest migratory bird week in across the nation. It's when our warblers are coming through. A lot of them are heading up to northern U.S., Canada region. So some of our summer resident species birds, too. And you get people by the thousands. Just in 2018, they had approximately 90,000 people.
Watching that, warblers?
Yeah, from 52 countries and 6 different continents.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and brought in $40 million of money, of revenue.
There are probably people in that group that you wouldn't want to be friends with. Yes. Because they're snooty.
Yes, and that's where I'm getting at. Yeah, so I've come across, I went there one time. And I always recommend, always go there, but just like you mentioned, I've mentioned that, yes, you may run into a lot of those kinds of people. Some people will be really nice and say, oh, yeah, that's that kind of bird. And some people, I'm not going to tell you. And
well, a lot of people love the idea, and I've gotten to that point. I now impart to my wife what that bird is. Yeah. And she's interested. I mean, she's my wife for 52 years. She better be interested. But it's fun to be able to identify it and tell. But if you're a bird watcher and you do know some stuff, pass the information along as a friend, not as look how smart I am type.
So I'm gonna correct you on something. Okay. So
my wife is not my friend.
No, no, I'm kidding. Now you said the term bird watcher.
Okay.
So if you're in the community of looking at birds,
don't call yourself a bird watcher.
No, do never call yourself a bird watcher. You will say you're a birder or you're birding.
Oh. Okay.
Now you're wondering what's the difference between birding and bird watching?
Snootiness.
Well, that's it. But before I give you the answer, just give me a guess. What do you think the difference is between bird watching and birding?
Well,
they are the same, but they are different.
I assume birding is learning about the birds, and bird watching is just looking at them.
Yeah, you nailed it.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. So bird watching, you're just basically admiring them. You're like, oh, you're a cute little sparrow, cute little robin, you know. But birding, you're really digging deep into their ecology, really understanding.
Trying to learn about
it. Yeah, you're trying to learn about it. And other than identification, I mean, you're learning about, you know, their lifestyle. How are they interacting with the environment? I had a guy once told me that birders are just basically ornithology junkies.
Oh, okay. So if you're going up to the wetlands up north, when 90,000 people are there watching the warblers come in, you're not watching warblers, you're birding.
Yeah,
and you're birding. At warblers.
And yes, and if you say you're bird watching, they are the type of people. And I never said it, but I heard somebody, it's called birding. And I'm like, oh my. It doesn't bother me. Some people are like, do you get offended? I'm like, no, I don't care. But some people do.
Yeah, I was going to give you an example of something that just irritates the heck out of me, but I'm going to leave it alone. I can do it on my political show, but I won't do it on this one.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Well, I'm learning a lot. I hope people don't think of it as a old person thing.
No.
Because I think there are a lot of younger people coming into it. Yeah,
there are.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, you're a younger person.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll admit, I mean, I get into it because obviously with my job and all. But I mean, there's a lot of times I just go out and, you know, I do it for leisure. And of course, I try to take my son along. And we're usually about 10 minutes in. And then after that, we're off playing with sticks and rocks, which don't get me wrong, we love
doing.
That's
good. Yeah.
But starting out that young age, we you know, slowly get into
it. He's about 5 or 6.
So yeah, he's 6. Yeah. So his attention span isn't that long.
Yeah. Well, my attention span's about as long as his. So, yeah, I can. But I'll tell you what, I'm going to have a hard time calling myself I'm birding. I am, because I really just like to look at them. I really do. I love looking at I have a pair of cardinals that have been in my yard at least 3 years.
Yeah.
And I just like looking at them.
Yeah, I admire them.
Yeah. I don't care if how they mate. I don't draw bird porno or anything like that. So, okay. All right. What else you got for us on the birds? What is there? Is there a place that you would suggest in this area is the best place to go bird watching? Birding.
Yeah, there you go. But before I go on to that, real quick about the binoculars, I totally forgot. About the ideal size, if you're starting out, is an 8x10. And then once you get into more serious birding,
eight
then...
8 by 10.
Yeah, so remember those two numbers we talked
the
about.
The first number is 8 and the second number is 10.
Yeah, okay. So an 8 by 10 pair of binoculars.
Easy to remember. That's the size of a normal photograph.
Yeah, there you go. And then a serious birders is usually an 8 by 42.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So you a 10 by 42. So,
okay.
Now, of course, again, you can go larger, but those are the kind of the standard sizes. So.
Now, what type of camera do you need if you want to shoot pictures of them?
I mean, it depends on what do you want to do. Thing, if you just want to take a little simple picture, you can just bring out the little
iPhone
pocket camera. But if you really want the really good pictures like you see on Facebook or on, or especially our social media, I mean, those are either the Nikons and the Canons. I mean, those
with the telephoto.
Ones. Yes, but the very long telephotic lens that can go up to 300, 500, 1,000 millimeters.
Yeah, wow.
And, of course, you know, with those going up, that means money is going to go up.
Oh, absolutely.
Too. They're huge, very expensive.
Money. Yeah. I was a media coordinator on the Pan American Games a long time ago. And because there were so many Cubans there, there was a lot of security. For some reason or other, that caused a lot of security. And we were on Lake Michigan. The photographers brought their normal cameras with them to take pictures of sailboats. Well, they wouldn't let us get within a mile because of security. So one guy showed up with a 600 millimeter lens that took two people to carry. It was huge back then.
Yeah.
And he told me how much it cost him back then. I can't remember what it was, but it was big bucks.
Oh, yeah.
And he was from the Chicago Tribune, so he was making good money, so he could afford it. Anyway, I digress. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Now, but back to your question about the ideal place to go birding. First off, I tell people, start in your backyard. You know, especially if you're very, very new. You know, you've mentioned just the birds that, you know, come in your area. And I mean, that's a great group of birds.
Well, not a lot of people have as many trees around them as I have.
And that, too. Yes, I was going to mention, not everybody's blessed to have, you know, a lot of vegetation or even a yard. Some people may not have anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, luckily here in Marion County, you know, we do have a lot of green spaces. I mean, you can go to your city parks and see birds. And you can go to, of course, Tallgrass Trail, see birds, Big Island Wildlife Area. So you don't have to go clear out to Yellowstone or Lake Erie or Hocking Hills.
I'd like to.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Don't get me wrong. They're great places. But a lot of people think you have to travel to all these elaborate places just to see
birds. Can you see unusual birds in this area if you're in your backyard?
Oh, yeah.
Are there some really crazy birds that come into this area?
Okay, yeah, yeah. Usually you get a lot of warblers that come in that usually are not there. Sometimes you'll get a lot of weird hummingbirds species that are not the rufous hummingbird, which is primarily a western species, but every once in a while they'll catch a weird air current or jet stream or a hurricane will push them up. And then you'll say, oh, hey, you're not supposed to be here. So now,
I have not seen an oriole, but I'm told there are lots of them in this area, I haven't seen one.
Come to a Tallgrass Trail.
Okay.
That first mile, especially right there before the lake, we usually have a lot of Baltimore orioles.
Okay.
Now, orchard orioles, a little different. Usually you have to go somewhere that has a little bit more trees. So if you go out to Teradice Nature Center or Nature Preserve, usually you'll see a lot of orchard orioles.
I don't know what an orchard oriole is.
They're darker.
Darker?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, Baltimore Orioles have a beautiful, it's not a coat.
A plumage.
Plumage.
Yeah, plumage.
Yeah, they are beautiful.
Yeah.
Especially, is it the male that's more colorful than the female?
Yeah, so it's funny you mentioned about that. For the most part, most birds are what's called sexually dimorphic. So that means that we're able to tell male and female based on physical appearance, like cardinals. They're bright red. The males are bright red. The females are dull brown. And then there are some birds that are called sexually monomorphic, which means that we can't really tell the difference.
Like robins, probably.
Well, robins a little bit you can tell. But
can you?
Yeah, chickadees, blue jays, crows, nuthatches, tuffetit mice, wrens, sometimes you can't tell between boys and girls.
Okay. Okay. Well, as long as they can tell, that's all that counts.
Well, and it's funny you mentioned that, which I kind of forgot to talk about the other kind of equipment you may need to go birding is clothing. Now, obviously, yes, we want to wear clothing, but what kind of clothing will determine how successful you'll be.
Yeah, naked birding is not a good
idea. No. Okay. So you want to wear more dark monotone colors.
Oh, so they don't see you?
Yes. But problem is if you wear like neon green, hunter orange, hot pink, anything really bright, birds see the world a little bit different than you and I.
Do they see color?
They do. They actually see color better than us.
Oh, okay.
So we have three different kinds of cone cells, and cone cells are the eyes or the cells in your eyes that help with color perception.
Right.
Birds have four different types.
Oh.
And what that extra one does for birds that doesn't do for people is they can see in ultraviolet light.
Oh.
So that's how some of those sexually monomorphic birds that both male and female look alike, that's how they can distinguish between boy and girl, because they will produce different ultraviolet lights.
Does that help them see better at night?
For owls, it does.
Okay.
But for like a robin or cardinal, they're not designed
to
do that.
All right.
So, yes, wearing those dark colors will help you.
Okay. I'm going to have to go get myself some dark colors.
Yeah. Well, what you're wearing, I mean, that would work.
Oh, this is very dark. Yeah. Black. Anyway, this is my favorite.
Oh, your Nutcracker.
Shirt.
I like
this
that.
This is my Nutcracker shirt that my grandchildren gave me at Christmas, and it says Christian. We're at the end of the hour here, and we're going to get James back here in the next hour, and we're going to talk about how you find alligators. No, we're not going to find that. I hope we don't find. Do people really throw alligators out?
Sometimes.
Oh, my
God. When I lived outside Richwood a few years back, somebody released an alligator near the Richwood Lake.
Can they live as long as it's warm?
As long as it's warm. So the summers they would survive, but our winters, no, they would not survive.
I bet, and they get really angry probably when it gets cold. Well, but they can't move very fast, right?
No, they're
reptiles.
No, they would actually die.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they would. Well, we will talk about all sorts of other critter stuff. You should see the number of books that he has in front of
him. And this is just a small collection. I have a big box in the car.
Now, do you carry all that with you when you go birding?
No, the one I'll carry is my Kaufman's. Okay. And sometimes if I'm looking for a lot of group of birds, sometimes I bring the Stokes, but then the rest, I just use it for programming.
Yeah, and sitting at home enjoying yourself.
Oh, right? Yeah.
It looks like they've all been used quite
a
bit.
Yes, especially my Kaufman and my Stokes. I have duct tape on them, so they go outside a lot, that's for sure.
All right. Well, we'll be back here at WWGH on my show. It's called On the Air with James Anderson today, who is the Marion County naturalist, and we'll be back and we'll be talking about more critters. So make sure you stay with us and join us here in about 15 minutes.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP Marion, Ohio, the place for guests like Dean of the White House Press Corps, Helen Thomas.
Helen, how do you deal with criticism? Because certainly 10 presidents, you've had your share of criticism. How do you deal with that?
Well, in the first place, you look at it and you see whether it's valid or not, and then you consider the source.
and then just
I just made up that answer.
And then onward and upward.
You're always a little bit miffed, of course, because everyone doesn't love you. But at the same time, you have to look at yourself and see whether they're right or not.
Do you go home at night, Helen, and think, my goodness, this person said that, this person said that? Does it keep you up at nights?
Well, I don't say it keeps me up at night. I have to think that nobody likes criticism, but sometimes it's very legitimate.
Final question I have for you, Helen, is probably the question I've been asked the most since I did the interview with you back in October of 2010. Why did you finally decide to speak, and how did it come about that you chose me to do the first interview?
Well, because you've been very kind, very fair. You don't jump in and attack me every time I open my mouth. I like that, and I think you're a fair reporter.
Streaming live on the internet at WWGH1071.com. Programming on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM is supported by CRT Mechanicals. Address 2842 Marion Waldo Road. Telephone number 740-225-4495. webpage, crtmechanicals.com. The Marion Towers Apartments are a supporter of WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Address, 400 Delaware Avenue. Phone number, 740-387-9050.
OhioNotary.us is a proud supporter of WWGH Radio. Telephone number 740-531-2326. Website OhioNotary.us, providing notarization services of any document anywhere in Mid and Central Ohio at homes and businesses. OhioNotary.us, a proud supporter of WWGH Radio.
We here at WWGH Radio 107.1 FM are proud to present Magnificent Marion Moments. In 1886, three newspapers operated in the town, including the Marion Star, with Warren G. Harding, eventual President of the United States, serving as the paper's editor. In addition to the newspapers, 15 churches and 4 banks existed in the community.
Hi, Ted Williams here, the man with the golden voice, and you're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, because Oscar Mayer has a way with B-O-L-O-G-N-A.
This is Scott Spears looking down on the beautiful city of Marion from the WWGH News Chopper. If you would like to ever submit a news tip or an event to the WWGH News Department, email Scott at WWGH1071.com and watch out for the chopper. And now a few words from Scott Spears, Charlie Evers, and the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams.
Hey Ted, what's the best part about being so well known?
Well, meeting all kinds of new people, you know, taking pictures and signing autographs.
That's great. What's the worst part?
That after selling a 500,000 autographs, I've got the worst case of carpal tunnel syndrome since John Hancock.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, the talking place. Scott Spears Now, Monday through Thursday from 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Guests like legendary Emmy Award-winning actress and the voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll, sharing a secret from her time in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
One of the big traditions for a lot of people on Thanksgiving is the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Yes, absolutely, and I was in it one year. I played Mother Goose.
Did you?
Yes.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, there was nothing to tell. I was dressed up like Mother Goose, and I was in this thing. And I must say, I had a secret little flask, because it was colder than a bear's ears. And I had a little nip of some good warm stuff occasionally. So I was a very happy Mother Goose by the end of the trip.
Oh.
There, that's a secret let out.
Oh, my God, that's a great story. So Mother Goose
was... Isn't that lovely?
Mother Goose had a few
nips. Oh, what fun it was, and the joy of the children and their parents and their brothers and their sisters along the route, just waving and having such a good time celebrating.
Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m., right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM.
Hello. If you listen and enjoy A Voice of a People with Linda Sims, help A Voice of a People to be better. A $10 donation a week pledge will support and sponsor A Voice of a People. And so by doing, you will have the privilege of your name, business, organization, church, or your favorite charity mentioned or announced during our broadcast and entered into a drawing which will be held weekly. Prizes will vary. I also want to say this. Anonymous donators are welcome and will be respected. Remember, if you want to make A Voice of a People a better program, a $10 a week donation /pledge will support and sponsor A Voice of a People.
A Voice of a People with Linda Sims can be heard twice weekly on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Monday and Tuesday from 4:10 p.m. to 5 p.m.
Hello, neighbors. This is Pastor and Bible teacher Craig Heilman, inviting you to join me this Sunday and every Sunday from 11:10 a.m. to 12 noon for Study His Word Radio. And that's exactly what we do. We'll take a few moments, open up God's Word, and study it. We'll also spend some time talking about current events that relate to the church. We'll have some interviews with local people of faith. We'll answer your Bible questions, and we'll take your comments about our study. So please, join me this Sunday, every Sunday, at 11:10 a.m., right here on WWGH 107.1.
Hi, gang, it's Gallagher. Do you know what time it is? No, you don't. That's why you need me to tell you it's time for the WWGH News. What is that? It's news about people, news about places and their plans. And what? It's live from the WWGH News Center. I'm Gallagher, but I told you that.
This is Adam Lepp in the WWGH Newsroom. Marion City Schools Board of Education President Leslie Schneider resigned from her position on Monday, March 21st. In her resignation letter, she said, "While I continue to value public education and the Marion City Schools, I am no longer in a position to fill my board service to its full potential, and it would be a disservice to the district and our community to continue." Former board vice president Kelly McKay will serve as board president until the end of the year. This announcement was not expected, according to Superintendent Dr. Ron Iarussi. A replacement must be named within 30 days of her resignation. A PDF application is available online and can be submitted to District Treasurer Veronica Reinhart at vreinhart@mcspresidents.org. As we transition into spring, the Marion Police Department reminds all drivers to slow down for safety. The warmer weather means more pedestrians, including children, will be out and about. Slowing down means everyone is safer. The Marion County Sheriff's Office will be switching to a new public notification system effective April 1st. The new system, known as HyperReach, will be replacing Nixle and is a free service to the public. You can call or text 419-845-5700 to register for phone and email alerts. From the WWGH Weather Center, just below seasonable for Thursday, cloudy with a high of 50, continued breezy, mostly cloudy, 38 for a low on Thursday night. Friday, cloudy skies continuing, we're expecting light rain in the afternoon with a high of 48. Then it gets somewhat interesting. Low in the mid-30s Friday night, rain in the evening, and light snow expected after midnight. We should only see a light accumulation. Saturday, cloudy with leftover light snow in the morning.